Hello, and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This podcast is brought to you by Texas Citizens Bank. Through good and tough times, you need a bank that will stand by you. Texas Citizens Bank gives Houston small and medium-sized businesses the resources they need to thrive. As one customer says, a huge thank you to our friends at Texas Citizens Bank. Great customer service and down-to-earth good people. Call 713-948-5700 to learn more today. In this episode, I'm catching up with Blair Guru, Managing Director of Houston-based Mercury Fund, a venture capital firm focused on early-stage investing of tech startups located in the middle of the country. Today, Blair and I will discuss how he's seen venture activity fare throughout 2020, both on a national scale as well as here in Houston. Plus, Blair explains what he's keeping an eye on ahead of 2021. Blair, thanks so much for joining me today on the last episode of the year for the podcast.
The last one. We're wrapping up 2020, finally. So,
yes, I know. I'm sure so many people agree, and the celebration that means to start new. But when I was thinking about what to discuss with you today, it was kind of hard because, frankly, Mercury Fund has had a lot of news come out recently that I've been covering. So I think we have a lot just to discuss in that way. But also, you're one of the kind of OGs in Houston innovation, and you really built Mercury Fund alongside of the city's innovation ecosystem. So we've got a lot to discuss, and we'll just go ahead and start with everyone's favorite topic, the pandemic. And especially since you were one of the first people I ever talked to about like kind of thinking about what COVID-19 would mean for, venture capital and for the innovation ecosystem in general. And you did this on my panel at the Tech Rodeo in March. So I think at the time you kind of compared it to seeing what, the 2008 recession did and how it was going to be an opportunity for the markets to basically correct. So I wonder now that we're kind of months and months later, what feels like years later, actually, how did that pan out, what you kind of originally envisioned for how, the COVID-19, it wasn't even a pandemic at the time, but how it would affect the markets?
Yeah, no, it was interesting. I was at a board meeting in California for one of my companies in February. Mm-hmm. When news first started coming out about this strange flu, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember when SARS first came out, and SARS actually had an effect on the markets. So we were thinking about selling this company in California, and the banker was giving us an overview, the investment banker, saying how he thought that would go. And I actually asked the question, I said, well, hey, if this coronavirus gets to the US and is really bad, is that going to slow down fundraising? Is it going to slow down the exit process, everything we're talking about? And he was like, huh, you're the first person to say that. I don't know how to answer that. I don't think so. I think we're fine, right? And kind of kept moving on. And it was just really odd. I never expected, obviously, what would have happened. I just expected the markets to correct, right? And how would that slow down things? The markets definitely corrected, right? The interesting thing to me, though, is that correction was, if you think about the S&P index, non-tech and innovation companies have lost a lot of their value. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tech and innovation companies have doubled their value. So the S&P overall has kind of stayed about the same. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, other exchanges being driven by why investors believe, what investors believe is where the value is in the economy, and that is tech and innovation. And obviously, people, smarter, more futurist thinking than I am, talk about how the pandemic has pushed the user adoption of technologies forward by a decade, if not two decades. And everyone finally understands that digital transformation is here to stay, automation is here to stay. This whole change or die imperative, it's everywhere. I mean, just look in our backyard, right? What the oil and gas industry has gone through when you had negative oil prices, right? for like 12 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever that was. So I don't think anyone could have thought through all of this, but it's put tech ecosystems on notice, because what's happened since the end of April to December is unprecedented in the tech space.
Yeah. Yeah. So what has been the biggest difference, I guess, from your perspective? I mean, one thing I'll mention is I saw Crunchbase reported that there's been about a 27% drop in funding for female-founded companies. And I think, you know, there are some ties into the pandemic. But at the same time, there has been activity, right? So what have you observed, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like us locally, out of our last four deals, two are female funded. And I just put a term sheet in yesterday on another female funded deal. You know, we were really deliberate a few years ago in building out more diverse relationships to find access to more female founders. And so I believe the capital is there for them if people can meet those founders. I think for a lot of firms that may not invest with that thought in mind, it may be a little uncomfortable, because it's been uncomfortable investing through the pandemic because people aren't meeting face to face. So they're either entrepreneurs they had in their pipeline, or they're investing in their own deals. But it's really, really difficult. And I think, you know, you had this upswing of, I think, female entrepreneurism from the standpoint that they were actually getting money and things were getting done. And I think there's lots of discussion out there about how to continue to improve that. You've got firms like Artemis, you know, that launched and been putting money to work. And, you know, we learn a lot from them. They kind of are a guidepost for us at our firm. But I think you're going to see that number change once people start going back to conferences, once people start meeting, once people start building out those relationships and those networks. Because I think we were on an upswing leading up to March, and then it kind of fell off.
Yeah, I think that kind of resonates with something I was hearing, you know, a few months ago from venture capital. You know, people tuned into that market. You know, it was people investing in people they already knew, because, you know, you can't meet face to face. But then also very, very warm intros, like introductions from people they know very well and trust. But has that kind of changed as the months, you know, went on? Do you think, you know, people got more comfortable with meeting via Zoom or phone calls, or even kind of socially distanced meetings? Did that change?
Yeah, I think it did. I think the later the stage of capital, right, when you get into growth equity and private equity and you're putting larger sums to work, I think more firms there need to meet people face to face, right? It's just the fiduciary they have to their investors and their funds for putting 10, 20, 40 million to work. You have to get face to face. When you're putting seed capital work, or even earlier stage, while in some instances it may be as important because you want to know how the founder works with you, right? Really working with a founder is about getting on the phone or getting on a Zoom with them, right? What is that dialogue like? Is it choppy? Are they good listeners? Are you a good listener as the investor? So you got to find a way to meet in the middle. And so I've found that the earlier stage investors have gotten to the point of comfort where they don't have to meet the founder. If they are local, i.e. Texas, we meet with them, right? If they're in the Midwest, somewhere with my partner, Adrian Fortino, who's up in Ann Arbor, can get to, then we'll meet with them. But we're getting ready to potentially do a deal where we haven't met the founding team in person at all. And that would be a first for us. But I think all of us are just comfortable, like this interaction, you know, that you and I are having, right, on Zoom. It's just how right now we're building relationships. And I think we've, as a society, have morphed to that. And we've gotten more comfortable with it.
Yeah. I wonder overall, which I know that there were kind of different segments over the past few months or several months that have happened, where different kind of parts have been affected differently. But was there one kind of type of fundraising round that was most affected? Because in the beginning, it was the seed rounds that I was seeing. No one was, you know, kind of meeting new entrepreneurs. They were kind of investing in bridge rounds or follow-up rounds. So, but has that changed too? Or is there one kind of segment of the kind of capital that's been most affected?
Yeah, I haven't seen the statistics yet. Truthfully, so this is more anecdotally based upon what we're seeing at Mercury. Seed rounds have definitely bounced back.
Okay.
We're seeing so much seed activity, but it's because there have been a lot of seed funds raised and there's a lot of active angel investing, because people are realizing the money is in innovation and tech, and especially software. I can't tell you how many individual investors I've met who call interested in investing in Mercury as a fund, interested in investing in our companies, interested in introductions into other funds. People are not getting the return they desire from the markets, and they're seeing tech companies just do great things. So there's capital flowing in, but it's flowing in to that early part of the funnel. I believe when you go to later stages, there's a lot less deals going on, maybe Series C, Series D round. Now, there may be larger investments being made, but I think they're into less companies. And I think that's largely due to the pandemic and the ability just to not meet face-to-face. So people are doing more sure things. With the IPO market opening up, you know, which has just been phenomenal the last 4 months, you can just almost tell which unicorns are attracting all the capital, which ones are marching forward, and which ones will go out. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's more the later stages it's been affected than the earlier stages. Now, April, May, nothing was happening, especially in a place like Houston. But now things are really moving, especially in places like Austin that, you know, just look at what's happened during the pandemic, right? People are leaving New York, San Francisco. They're leaving the coasts and they're moving inland, right? Austin, Atlanta, Miami, Nashville, some are coming to Houston, but Austin's really been the recipient of a lot of those people.
Wow. Well, speaking specifically about Houston, I know the HTX funding review that came out, I guess, you know, a few months ago, even though it feels like it just came out. What is time? It looked back at the first kind of half of the year and Houston's startup funding was up. So I wonder if that kept trending, if you kept observing that. And also, you know, would it have been higher in a different situation, or is this kind of what you would have expected from this year, pandemic or not?
Yeah, I think we were trending higher.
Yeah.
Frankly. You know, we're slightly up, but you know, numbers can be moved around. I can make the case we're actually down. But I think by the end of the year, once some later stage or some funding rounds in December that closed that PitchBook and others haven't captured yet. I think, you know, I was telling Chris from the HBJ the other day about this. I think we're going to be flat to slightly up, you know, from a PitchBook perspective. But think about the work that HX and HX Venture Fund were doing, right? The number of firms that applied for capital through the HX Venture Fund, fund of funds, you know, was in the hundreds. And, you know, Guillermo and Sandy and now Elise Hobson, you know, their head of business development, they've done a great job bringing those venture firms to town, as well as, you know, Houston Exponential, you know, bringing people in. This is something we did at Station way back when, trying to introduce them around. And there was a real interest in Houston because it was largely untapped from a venture perspective. All that stopped, right? And I think HX has done a really nice job of doing virtual sessions with those investors. But those virtual sessions haven't necessarily led to a lot of investments. Because again, what you'd said about earlier, I think if you haven't invested in a certain city and you're new to the city and you're new to building a relationship with an individual and you don't necessarily know how you're going to build that company in that city, then you're going to stall out a little bit. And so most of the capital I think that's flown in to Houston has either come from firms like us here or from groups that were already talking to firms, you know, prior to the pandemic.
I kind of have a question. I think I'm just interested in knowing, since you do kind of business with other, you know, VCs and startups from this kind of middle section of the country. And, you know, when you meet a VC that has interest in Houston, what are they attracted to? What do you see that they find an interest in?
First, cheap deals, right? It's an arbitrage opportunity because deals have gotten so expensive. They're really interested in coming into Houston, finding great companies run by middle American founders that are reasonably priced. And that doesn't mean that Houston founders have to take a discount, but in places like Austin or Chicago, the pricing has just gone bonkers, right? 20 million pre-monies on deals for companies that have no revenue. It's just not sustainable, like that kind of pricing, right? So they're very interested in coming into Houston. They're very interested in the diversity of Houston, pockets of diversity, you know, in, you know, the Black or Hispanic markets where there could be great entrepreneurs that people haven't heard about, opportunities there. They're also interested in consumer, right? You know, companies like Good Fare, or another real up and coming company called Upgrade, They're hearing about these deals out there that are largely direct-to-consumer deals, and they're wanting to know, hey, are there others? Because I think people have an understanding that Houston is more driven by energy and life sciences, so they assume that those deals are kind of picked over and the best ones are funded. But are there other companies that, you know, HX has seen, Mercury has seen, other groups like that? And that's what they really ask about. You know, the thing that's been most difficult, I think, on the city and the tech community has been, and I've heard this from at least 20 VCs, when the pandemic hit and oil prices dropped and largely people as investors got out of the oil sector, that affected the VC market for energy tech as well. And so you've seen a lot of those companies struggle to raise capital. Now, an area that is on the upswing is climate tech. And so I think Greentown Labs launching its newest cohort, you know, its first one in Houston. I get calls and emails about Greentown all the time. And so it's just awesome pushing those over to Jason and Juliana, because I think that's going to be probably one of the fastest growing areas in the city for capital infusion over the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you mentioned kind of making a lot more deals locally for Mercury Fund this year. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because we're not traveling, right? I mean, most of us spend half our time on planes, yeah. And we're constantly building relationships in cities all, you know, across the middle of the country. And so we've been doing everything locally. And because of that, you know, it's not like I'm going to conferences or events and seeing you, right? We're doing this. But because we've spent more time here, for some reason, the deals have kind of trickled in. And we started seeing people in our office socially distanced back in May. Mm-hmm. You know, our offices are such where they're all glassed in on the outside so we can all come to work if we want and not have to interact, mm-hmm. but be able to get out of our house, you know, should we be more productive here. So I've been coming in since late April. So we've been inviting companies in to the office to present to us if they feel comfortable. And, you know, we've needed that interaction. And I think from that interaction, we've seen more companies. And we've taken more bets. So we've made four investments, new investments in Houston companies in 2020. One is a pretty sizable investment that will be announced probably in the next 30 days that we did with Amplo, where, you know, they and we kind of co-led that deal. Super excited about that company. We think that company has the ability to become the next High Radius. I mean, their growth is just, you know, phenomenal. Then we made three seed investments in companies that were almost quasi-incubating here at Mercury, where we'd open up our office space for people. And that's just been a lot of fun. So, you know, in some ways, we haven't missed a beat. You know, people are asking, how's my work cycles changed without traveling? I've never been busier. Like, there's so much activity in the venture market. I am on Zoom or the phone from 8 a.m. till like 7 p.m. Every single day. And, you know, I used to catch up on email or work on plane rides. Now I have to catch up on the weekends. So my family's kind of sick of it. But it's been, it's just been weird, because you look out there in the larger ecosystem or in the larger universe, and, you know, there's lots of industries that are just getting hammered, right? And people are out of work. And that's just not the case in tech. You know, tech is really in this resurgence, and it'll be interesting to see how that bleeds over to the rest of the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. So on top of these new companies, and I'm sure maybe this was the focus kind of March, April, May, but helping to guide your portfolio companies during this time, what was that like? I know I covered a couple of the pivots, like Spruce, and also everything that Televet has been doing has been very timely. So how was that?
Yeah, you know, the first couple of months of the pandemic, I think like other investors, we were just, you know, in triage mode. Mm-hmm. We were making sure all of our companies had capital. And I think that's why you saw such a decrease in investment across the board. Everyone just like taking care of their own, right? Huddling the family together, making sure everyone was good. And then we had to decide, can this company survive the pandemic? Can they survive a contactless sales environment? Nobody can get on planes. No one can shake hands to close a deal. Can they get stuff closed on Zoom? Most of our companies that have lower annual contract value, kind of lower ACV as we call it, and they can thrive in a contactless environment, because their sales cycle is 2 to 3 weeks. And you and I can have 2 Zoom calls and you're like, done, Blair, here's my credit card number, I'll buy. Those companies have done great. The companies that sell into enterprises, longer sales cycles, it's been really, really difficult. And then we've had some companies like Spruce, right? You know, the concierge platform for apartment buildings. When tenants slowed their purchases March, April, May, they started providing things directly to the apartments, right? Mm-hmm. Disinfectant cleanings, more B2B type services. You know, we got lucky with our investment in Televet, which we did prior to COVID, and with their telemedicine platform for vets, that just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. But then as vets started finding that people didn't necessarily want the help from home, they actually wanted to come in and do curbside. So if you think about going to HEB and getting curbside pickup, people are doing the same thing at their vets, right? They're parking their car in the parking lot and they want the vet to come out, grab their cat or dog and bring them inside. And they want to, you know, talk about it on the video. Well, Televet didn't necessarily do that. So that's something they had to pivot very quickly to offer. And there's been other things that the, you know, COVID has driven, which they've been able to do that. And so I'd say maybe 20% of our companies truly benefited from the pandemic because they had products that were kind of pandemic, you know, plus. But we probably had 20 to 30% that, you know, they didn't hit their sales targets. Their revenues are lower just because they sold into enterprises and enterprises had a really tough time making decisions quickly. And I think that's largely what's happened in the oil and gas space, right? Mm-hmm. These oil and gas software companies just have a really hard time selling into Exxon broadly because Exxon's got its own issues and they aren't looking to make those massive purchases like they were before.
Yeah. That's interesting because I would almost feel like it's a good time to invest in, and you know, that type of software that can help you, you know, kind of save money. These big companies that really hurt from the oil prices. So that's not what you're saying, is what you're saying, or is it going to be the near future that happens, or what do you think?
Yeah, I would say not as much. Now, I'm sure there's some software companies out there that are doing well that I may not know about. They would raise their hand and they're like, no, Blair, we think you're wrong. But if you look at the deals that were raising capital over the last 2 or 3 years, they were more data-driven, right? Data science platforms. Companies that were making energy companies rethink how they were drilling, how they were operating, you know, using data in ways that they hadn't necessarily done before. Those companies take a lot of sign-offs to get approved within a large organization, like an energy company. And those companies are having a much tough time getting contracts signed as quickly and really ramping up on that revenue scale. And, you know, when a company has flat revenue for a few years, they're just, you're better off selling, right? Because the VC just turns to another deal. You know, it loses its luster in the market. It just gets really hard. And so, I mean, there's just, you know, some entrepreneurs just have a real tough time with it out there. And so hopefully with the vaccine making its way through the system, you know, by mid next year, they'll start to see an uptick on those in-person meetings and get done what they need done.
Yeah. You mentioned the vaccine, and I almost wonder, you know, when did that start affecting the markets that you saw? Is it just now happening, or right when it was announced that these vaccines were going to be able to hit the market? Is when it happened?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. If you take a step back, I think when Operation Warp Speed, isn't it called? You know, the Trump administration push for. And whether or not you're pro or against Trump, you have to credit his administration. Like, that was remarkable what they were able to kind of do. When that happened and all that money went to Moderna, you know, I think they got $850 million, right, to drive their trials through, the biotech market started going crazy, right? I mean, there's been such a resurgence in life sciences investing, especially in biotech. Mm-hmm. So many companies have gone public, just a real focus on public health and the kind of disease prevention. I think to your point, when we knew that the vaccines would start rolling out around election time, I don't know if the venture markets improved, but definitely kind of the esprit de corps, right? I could just tell, just talking to my CEOs that I work with and the companies, everyone just felt better, right? There was light at the end of the tunnel and things were kind of pushing through. Now, most of our startups, they have a lot of young people on staff, but I find a lot of young people to be progressive. And so I think the Biden-Harris ticket winning that was a good shot in the arm too for a lot of our companies. But you know, it'll be interesting. I think next year, you know, we've been looking at the Georgia runoffs really closely, right? If the Republicans win and the Democrats don't have the swing vote in the Senate, so that Biden, Harris, and other Democrats can't just push things through, that may be best for markets. I think that'll be a stabilizing factor for markets. If the Democrats do win and change and all sorts of stuff is pushed through, while a lot of people may applaud that, it may be best for America. It may not be best for the venture markets overall. So it'll be interesting to see how those things pan out.
Yeah. Do you mean from like a terms of like the stabilizing?
Yeah. The stabilizing effect, right? Because if, you know, just from the far right to the far left, if one side has more swing, that destabilizes markets in a big way. And for venture to work, that's the case. But make no mistake, I mean, I think the reason there's so much money in venture right now is you've got, you know, a Fed rate of basically zero, and people have to put their money somewhere. So it's just unprecedented amounts of capital flowing into funds, flowing into deals. Like, I've never seen this in my 20-year career.
Yeah. I think I always underestimate how connected everything in our country is, and how kind of all these different aspects can really affect, you know, everything really.
Yeah. And it's wild because, like, as an entrepreneur starting a company, you don't necessarily focus on all of that, right? You just, you've got your hustle on, you're moving forward and you're raising money and you're going to get it done by hell or high water. But there's a lot of things that'll happen in the next 60 days that'll really drive the next, you know, 12 months, 18 months.
Yeah, a lot to look out for. Well, one thing I want to ask you about, which is kind of, you know, completely off topic, but did come out this week, or last week, I should say, the investment in Topple. So tell me a little bit about Topple. I love talking about Topple, and Kim's been on the podcast before. She's the best. So why is that a company that you're really interested in, and what do you see its potential for, really?
Yeah, it may surprise you. You know, first off, I think our whole firm just is absolutely taken aback by Kim, right? Mm-hmm. Who she is, her co-founders, you know, what they've done to date. I mean, I think that she's one of the faces of the future of entrepreneurship, right? Especially in Houston. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're big believers in Houston, and if Topple wins, Houston wins big, right? Female-led deal, blockchain, Rice University, but more importantly than all of that is this whole notion of ESG. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Kim and I first met here at Mercury. We had done the Female Founders Breakfast last year. And she was brought up by our associate, Lily Liu, made the introduction early in the year. I think it was January. And we really hit it off. This whole notion of the world needing to track, trace, and verify ESG is something that now seems obvious, right? Every company is thinking that. Pre-COVID, not so obvious. I was really interested in doing a seed investment there, mostly because of my daughters. And so both of my daughters have gone through Montessori school at the Post Oak School here locally. And in doing that, they're able to do what's called Montessori Model UN. So most Model UN programs are in high school, but in the Montessori, it's in fourth grade. So each of them got to work with part of their school that actually did that program, got a country, wrote country reports, and then would go to the UN every year to present them with about 3,000 other young people globally. And so for the last, you know, 7-8 years, you know, my wife and I have been indoctrinated into the UN Sustainable Development Goals, into why ESG is important. Mm-hmm. And if you're around it long enough, it really starts to sink in, right? I mean, you can be negative against it. You can not believe in it. But trust me, when your kids are believers and you hear the speeches and you see why it matters, there are goals out there that you can ascribe to, right? We'll take ESG. What we saw in the markets pre-COVID was an institutional investor market that was largely ignoring energy. Right? They were moving away from carbon. You had activist investors getting involved. You had the entire Me Too movement. You had
boards being very specific about both gender and racial equity, putting people and representatives on boards. And so we made a seed bet believing that the world would move that way, where in the future, brands would be judged by consumers by whether or not they could track their sustainable and ethical business practices. And I had never met anyone besides Kim and her co-founders, you know, Chris and James, who could articulate it as well. Now, they've got a lot of work to do, right, to bring their product to market. They've made huge strides in the last 6 months. But we felt pretty good seeing the market kind of come together. And it's sad that it takes a pandemic plus the fires in California, plus the murder of George Floyd, and the protests afterwards to really wake people up to, you know, the ESG movement. But I think we as a firm believe that term will probably go away. We think ESG and impact is just going to be woven into the fabric of society, both in fund managers and funds and companies. I think you'll hear people talk more about the UN Sustainable Development Goals in the future. And if Kim and her team can be the platform that validates and verifies that, like, how cool is that? I mean, that has the ability to completely rewrite the narrative for Houston, which people largely see as a carbon-driven town. And that's not necessarily the case. So many energy companies are looking to rewrite that narrative, but you're talking about someone that could basically be like Standards and Poor's or Moody's and rate all of these companies around how they're doing things. So super, super exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very cool. I mean, first of all, I did Model UN in high school, and now I'm picturing a bunch of fourth graders, and it's adorable, but also so inspiring because they are the future, right? But yeah, and kind of what you're saying is we're closely up upon a time where companies are going to have to be able to prove that they are doing things sustainably and really like show the proof. And a company here in Houston is able to do that for them, which is just the best, right?
Awesome. And it's female led, right? Which, you know, takes a mother's touch. So.
Exactly. And we're all in the Kim fan club. So it's a great place to be. So speaking of, you know, people, I know Mercury Fund's other big news recently has been the addition of Samantha Lewis and the promotion of Heath Butler. And I guess, you know, kind of, you know, so closely on a new year and with these this news, what are you focusing on with Mercury Fund going into 2021?
Yeah, you know, first off, we're so fired up about Heath and Sam. You know, Heath has been with us now for a year. And he came on originally to help really manage our network, and really help build stronger partnerships with some consulting firms we use with our companies, including MBS and other things like that. And he's so good with entrepreneurs, and he's just been helping out everyone, and he's been great. So it was a great promotion, kind of well-deserved. Really excited he's my partner. And then for us, building out that investment team, you know, we're constantly trying to drive diversity of thought. And so we were very deliberate in kind of seeking out, you know, a woman to add, you know, to the investment team. And so we talked to, you know, dozens and dozens of people across the middle of the country. And, you know, we ended up coming back home, right? Because it always kind of came back to Samantha Lewis. And so really excited to add her on the team. And again, you know, she's been here for like a week and a half and just is adding a ton of value, right? It's just like she's always been here. So when we look out over the next year, if I think about, you know, the existing team that's here, you know, Adrian Aziz, you know, Dan, you know, Lily, myself, and then the addition of Heath and Sam, we can just do more better, right? We're going to go out for our fifth fund, hopefully by the end of next year. You know, hopefully we'll raise a little bit more money so we have more people. But we just have the ability to kind of keep expanding our networks out. I don't think the fact that you know, two of our last four deals being women led is I don't think that's going to necessarily change over time. And I think, you know, Sam's network and being very focused on the female founder is going to help. You know, we also are looking at having a higher percentage of minority founders, and finding just awesome, you know, niche opportunities by diverse led, founding groups. And, you know, Heath is helping to lead the charge there. Along with, you know, just investing, you know, in entrepreneurs kind of overall. But one of the things that he brings to the table, and one of the reasons why we hired him in the first place, is he helped to run corporate development at Disparity, which, you know, Houston-based company, but one of the leading human capital management platforms. So we've been spending a lot of time, and he's been building out a thesis around tools that help the new face of work. You know, think of the gig economy, think of 1099 employees, just think of workers overall. You're going to have so many people displaced out of their jobs. They need to come back into the workforce. So many people looking to be retrained. You know, knowledge workers have obviously taken an upswing. And we started to make some investments in and around that area. This new investment in Houston is in that area. And it's one that Keith led. You know, he'll be the partner in charge on it. That the deal that we did with Amplo. So human capital management is a big piece. And then the other theme we've been talking openly about is this notion of the digitization of customer journeys. So if you're a business and you want to provide a product or a service to someone else, how is your ability to do that digitized? And that's something that COVID has really pushed forth and forward because of the digitization of everything. That could be in retail, that could be manufacturing, that could be lots of things. And so those are two themes along with some other ones that we are really, really excited about.
Yeah. So similarly, kind of talking about the future, and I know you're very tapped into the Houston innovation ecosystem. So what should Houston be focused on with this new year?
Yeah, I think we've did such a good job over the last 2 years of attracting branded acceleration programs to town, right? Like, I'm so excited about Greentown and G-Beta. I mean, Mass Challenge and the work that John, you know, Norby's doing there. Plug and Play, so excited about Ion opening, right? And, you know, DivInc from Austin is going to open an office there. You know, Capital Factory, right, taking over some of the operations of Station. Everything Grace is doing at Impact Hub. I mean, we are just now hitting our stride, right, with all of these groups, all these individuals. That's really, really exciting. You know, I talked earlier about all the good work that HX Venture Fund is doing. I think they've made 12 investments now into funds all across the country, and they're doing their best to bring them into Houston and interface with us. But the thing I worry most about is seed capital. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, HX Venture Fund is invested in lots of funds that do a little bit later stage than seed. And Series A, and then beyond. They've already made a few investments in town like Lion Guard. They've really done some good work. But if you look at other cities outside of the coast, what really makes them hum is a constant source of seed money to kind of fund the junior varsity so it can get to the point of being the varsity and attract the capital in those larger institutional rounds. I really think that we need multiple seed funds. They're going to put a large percentage of their money to work in Houston so we can build the next generation of companies. You know, the last time there was a lot of influx of seed money was when we got Station off the ground and groups like Lion Guard and Spruce and a bunch of others kind of got there going. But that seed money, and this is a nuance, really needs to be tied to mentorship. And so the seed money from a fund, say like Artemis, that's tied to mentorship, right? That Diana or Leslie or Stephanie brings in. But if it's coming just from an angel investor, that angel may or may not put the advice and the mentorship that's required to get that company off the ground, right? Joe Allopath, founder of Lion Guard, often talks about, you know, he had 20 mentors and advisors after he raised his seed round, you know, that was led by, JR and the Station Houston Fund, which is now integrated, and Keith Butler when he was independent from us. And so that's the thing we've been trying to figure out. We put a round table together at HX, which includes myself, JR, Stephanie, Rakesh Agarwal, and a few others to kind of think through that problem and make some recommendations about, do we need to attract more seed funds to town? Does the city need to build more seed funds? Should those seed funds be around just general entrepreneurship, or should it be specific, right, around women-led businesses, you know, Black-run businesses, Hispanic-run businesses? You know, we're the most diverse city in the U.S. I think we need to be more deliberate about putting capital work in that diversity. And so all of these things start in that seed round. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that keeps me up at night, wanting the best for the city and wanting to see us progress over the next, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. I'm like picturing almost like a timeline for Houston, and the past few years have definitely been focusing on those accelerator programs and almost like the infrastructure, right? The ION, I'm kind of bringing these things to fruition. And so now we're moving into this phase of focusing on early stage funding and bringing that to town.
Yeah, you know, I just caught up with John Norby the other day, was catching up with, you know, a few people over at ION Station earlier, and they've got the companies coming through, right? And they're getting resources to grow. And if you ask them what they need, it's capital, 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 capital. And so how can we put a pool of capital together where each one of those programs maybe gets access to it to be able to kind of cherry pick the best deals coming out of their programs, with the recommendation and the stipulation that they stay here in Houston, right? Because all of these groups, including Team CX, right, it continues to do it, just a bang-up job, everything that's going on over there. They bring lots of companies in from outside of Houston, right, with a goal that if they land a clinical trial or if they sell into the medical center with their health tech, the hope is that they leave jobs and teams and offices here, right? Well, you could really do that with capital and kind of push the envelope in order to drive more companies and more jobs. I think as a city, we have to start doing that more, and we got to be thinking that way, or we'll lose pace. Because if you thought the pace of innovation was fast prior to COVID and that other cities were getting beyond us, holy cow, it's really, really starting to happen now. But, you know, all eyes are kind of in the middle of the country, especially in states like Texas, that are great business climates, no state income tax, just all those positives. And so I think Houston could be a real leader, you know, over the next 10 to 20 years if we play our cards right.
Yeah, got to keep people in Houston. And as long as they're coming, you know, not in a hurricane or in the middle of summer, it's a great city. Listen.
See, exactly, Natalie. So you got to get on your podcast too when it's nice and sunny. So.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we could keep going and keep talking about Houston forever because that's my favorite topic, but I feel like that's why this is a good place to wrap up. So I really appreciate you coming on the show. I feel like I have so much I'm thinking about just from listening to you today, and I'm sure listeners are in the same boat as me now. So thanks again for wrapping up the podcast on a very high note.
Well, no, listen, Natalie, I mean, on behalf of everyone says this all the time, thanks for everything that you do, you know, at Innovation Map and the entire, you know, Culture Map, Innovation Map ecosystem. It is so good to have an outlet which is consistent and upbeat about all the good work that entrepreneurs are doing here. So hats off to you.
Yeah, I have no shortage of news to cover here. So I appreciate, it's a mutually beneficial relationship, right?
Awesome. Well, listen, here's to 2021. We are done with 2020.
Yes, such a great, yep. See you next year.
Right.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.